Welcome to The Loins of History, a podcast connecting the past to the present and improving political and historical literacy. I'm your host, Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. And we're going to continue in this series on the fall of the French Third Republic and actually bring this mini-series to an end. So this has been actually one of my favorite mini-series that we've done on the French Third Republic because so much of it is, I think, overlooked. Yeah. I think I've said this in a few different episodes, but most people remember from World War II, you know, appeasement. That's one thing that they always remember, appeasement, and the French surrendered really quickly. So like, that's almost from an American standpoint, what we remember. We don't look at the French Third Republic holistically, where it's this political entity that exists, but it's wobbly from its start at best. And really had no chance to stand up to the Germans. And there was a lot of internal friction that really set them up to collapse once the full force of the Germans came down on them. So it's been a very interesting miniseries, to say the least, and definitely one of my more favorite ones, like I said. So, and I also think it's very applicable to today. You can see a lot of, I think it was two or three episodes ago where, you know, right before, it was right after, I think the Germans had taken Czechoslovakia and, you know, that they had signed a, you know, what's his name? Neville Chamberlain had flown back to England and he was given a hero's welcome and everybody thought it was going to be okay, but there was still kind of this unease and tension that everybody who was in power and some well-informed individuals knew that it wasn't. And they just kind of knew. I get that sense now. And I think a lot of Americans are starting to pick up on it. So just kind of an interesting observation.
Yeah, there's so many good lessons learned from France. And to our listeners, I really encourage y'all to go back through, if this is the first time you're listening to us, to go back through and start at the beginning of our series on the fall of the French Third Republic, just to really like paint that picture, because we can't, this episode is going to talk about Vichy France as well as summarize some of those lessons learned. But, you know, this is, we're going on 7 hours of content on France, and it's, there's no way we can capture all those things in one episode. And yeah, to your point, Colin, some of our previous case studies about the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Byzantine Empire, the fall of the Han Dynasty, they're good. Like, they're good case studies to see why civilizations collapse, but they were thousands, I mean, except for the Byzantine Empire, you know, they were thousands of years ago. Byzantine Empire obviously was around for a long time, collapsed in the 1400s. But with France, you know, we're not even 100 years removed from 1940, which that's an odd thought, that we're actually a little over 80 years removed, I think, math in public, from 1940, 84 years to be exact, and almost, it'll be 84 years this summer. But that's still like a relatively recent case study when a major Western European nation just completely fell apart at the seams. And like you said, Colin, I think it's really applicable, especially when you start peeling back the political causes as well as the military causes for what happened in France.
So Jay, with that being said, last week we left off where the French had surrendered. You know, the Germans had made their move through the Ardennes, overwhelmed the French. They essentially surrendered within 6 weeks of being attacked, and the government went into exile. So I think that's kind of where we stopped. So what happened then?
Yeah. So we kind of left off with the armistice. And I just wanted to go over a little bit more detail on how the armistice came to be. Some of our history buffs out there, I'm sure, have heard some of this information, but some of it maybe not so. So like we discussed in our last episode, on the 22nd of June, after the complete and utter collapse of what was once the mightiest army on continental Europe, the French army, the government had fled to Bordeaux for the most part. And there was this crisis in the cabinet. There was Raynal and his vice premier, Pétain. And Pétain was a marshal of France. He was the highest rank, one of the highest ranking military officers, but he had retired. He was in his 80s. He was known as the Victor of Verdun during World War I, and he had been brought back from being the ambassador, the French ambassador to Spain, to try to shore up the cabinet, bring some prestige, bring some solidarity. And he ended up working against Raynal and had ulterior motives in seeking for an armistice. So towards the end of what was known as the Battle of France, after the entire French army collapsed, Raynal did not want to ask for an armistice. He wanted to do what the Netherlands did in the Queen, which was to flee to the French colonies in North Africa and continue the war from there, because they the French government had signed an agreement with Great Britain that they would not do an armistice, that they would not make a separate agreement with Nazi Germany, and that they would continue to fight. So Raynal wanted to take the government to North Africa, but Pétain was like, no, we need to ask for an armistice. This war is over. We can't do anything about it, etc. And more the ministers in the government started agreeing with him. Well, when they said, hey, we want an armistice, Raynal resigns and Pétain takes over. And shortly after Pétain takes over, they start asking for an armistice. Real quick, it's important to note, Pétain and another guy that was brought in to kind of shore up the military, and his name was Maxime Weygand. Both Pétain and Weygand were pro-monarchists. They were conservative. They hated the Third Republic, specifically the Popular Front that was led by Léon Blum. And if y'all remember from a couple episodes, the Popular Front was a union primarily of the parties on the left, with the radical socialists, the socialists, and the communists, even for a little bit. So it was kind of this coalition government that wasn't exclusively moderates and folks on both sides. It was like moderates and mostly people on the left. So when Pétain and Weygand got in charge, they were like, we're sympathetic towards the fascists. We want to end this war and we don't like the Third Republic. So that's kind of, we see the writing on the wall here for the ending of the Third Republic. So the nature of the armistice kind of fits this. And in the middle of June, they send out feelers to the Nazis, and Hitler himself demands that this armistice be signed in the woods at Compiègne, which is the exact spot that the armistice in 1918 was signed. He made them go get the exact boxcar that the armistice was signed in, bring it back to the woods, have the exact same chair. So the French commander that accepted the armistice on the French side was a guy named Foch. We've talked about Foch a few episodes ago. But Hitler sat in the exact same chair that Foch sat in to accept the German armistice. And after the preamble to the agreement, it only took him a day to negotiate the terms of the armistice. He got up right after they read the preamble and just walked out as this like measure of disdain. Like, I can't even bear to be in the same room with you French people. And apparently that's exactly what Foch did too when he signed the agreement. So like all of this was a calculated middle finger to the French by Hitler. And it was very much this revenge, and the Pétain government signed it and went along with it. The terms that created what we know as Vichy France, in French, it was known as the French state. I'm not going to try to pronounce that, but what we know as Vichy France, the terms of that armistice were basically the Nazis were going to occupy about 3/5 of what's known as metropolitan France, i.e. what the mainland of France, as opposed to the French colonies. So 3/5 of metropolitan France, to include all of the Atlantic and Channel ports, were going to be occupied by the Germans. they had to return everyone who had been granted asylum. So think all the people that fled Germany when Hitler took over and went over to France, all the people that had fled Belgium, all the people that had fled the Netherlands, all the people that fled Poland, fled Czechoslovakia, that had made their way to France. They had to hand them back over to Nazi authorities and the Gestapo. The indemnity was 400 million francs a day to Berlin. The Navy, which the Brits cared quite a bit, France actually had a decent sized Navy. And if, you know, I think we talked about this elsewhere, but the Germans basically had no Navy to speak of. They did not have a very large surface fleet. They were primarily building U-boats and only had like a couple battleships or battle cruisers. Whereas the French even had an aircraft carrier at this point. They had several battleships, one aircraft carrier, and, you know, the British wanted this nullified. So what was going to happen with the French Navy was a big deal. In this armistice, they agreed that the French Navy would be disarmed, i.e. they were literally going to remove the guns off the ships, but it wasn't going to be disbanded. They weren't going to completely get rid of the Navy. Later, the British would actually attempt bombing those same ships.
For the British, of course, they thought, I mean, they were very concerned about those ships, because if the Germans suddenly had a Navy, they had another threat to deal with for an invasion of Britain. Not just an aerial assault, you know, there's the Battle of Britain taking place in the sky, but now it might happen on the sea, because if the Germans were able to take over those ships, suddenly now Britain does not have complete dominance of the waters, because the Germans have U-boats and battleships now. That would be a huge dilemma for the British. So of course they were concerned about that.
Right, for sure. And then last but definitely not least was the return of Alsace-Lorraine to Germany. And that was completely occupied by Nazi Germany. Of note, the area that wasn't occupied, what we know is like the territory of Vichy France, up until 1942, it was completely unoccupied and self-administered. Vichy France agreed to be neutral, so it didn't even become technically a puppet state of the Third Reich. It became what's called a rump state, i.e. it's what's left over, but kind of neutralized in the sense. But it did not, Germany wasn't its sovereign at that point. However, we kind of all knew who's calling the shots. And in 1942, the Third Reich did in fact completely, actually both the Nazis and the Italian fascists completely occupied even Vichy France while maintaining a nominal independence. So Charles de Gaulle had actually already fled to London after the fall of Paris. Charles de Gaulle would later become the symbol of Free France and would form a counter government that said that Vichy France was not the legitimate government of France. Interestingly enough, everything that occurred in Compiègne, like Vichy France actually was the legitimate government of France, but because in the term that would get thrown around later, as we kind of transition to talking about more about Vichy France, is collaborationist. And it was kind of viewed that because Vichy France collaborated with the enemies, i.e. the Third Reich in Italy, that delegitimized their government, and that de Gaulle was able to, you know, form this counter-government in London. After the war, after the liberation, and de Gaulle later became the president and all this stuff, they would actually charge with crimes French officials for collaborating. I believe only 4 were executed. One of our listeners might have fact-check me on that one. There wasn't like these big Nuremberg trials, but Pétain was later had a trial and he was sentenced to death, but de Gaulle commuted his sentence and didn't put him to death. So it's like, even though technically they were the legitimate government of France, they still paid for collaborating with the Nazis. Before we get into our discussion, I kind of wanted to talk about, as kind of the the final impact of the collapse of the Third Republic. Like, it wasn't merely that France lost the war. It was that the institution of the Third Republic no longer existed, and that there's consequences to that. The Third Republic was a democracy. It had a president, it had two chambers in its legislature. Everyone, not everyone, but most officials were democratically elected. And that entire system went away, and there were consequences. And one of the main ones was just French citizens died, a lot of them. And after, and during World War II, just to highlight the one group that's really obvious, was Jews that then came under Nazi rule. Like, because the Third Republic could no longer protect its citizens, its former citizens were now subject to the Third Reich, which obviously didn't like Jews. We still don't know today exactly how many Jewish people and families were executed by the Third Reich, but the general estimates are somewhere around 75,000. And just to kind of put that into perspective, and we've brought this analogy up a few times in previous episodes, but just to compare, like, less than 4,000 Americans died on September 11th, and we went to war for 20 years in multiple different countries, caused all, like, trillions of dollars of money spent, damaged, you name it, for the loss of less than 4,000 Americans. And personally, what happened on September 11th was a tragedy. Only what's the word? Similar in our nation's history as Pearl Harbor. Like, it was one of the worst instances. That's unfathomable compared to just the 75,000 Jews that were completely wiped off the face of the map. Not to mention all the battle casualties from World War II. Kind of think along the same line of thought about the Munich Conference and the remilitarization of the Rhineland. Like, these decisions seem small, but millions upon millions of people died in World War II. And World War II is an entirely preventable conflict. Like, it didn't have to happen.
You said something really key right there. These decisions. So, you got to think of it like, I think it was Stalin that said, the death of one man is a tragedy, the death of a million men is a statistic. It's kind of, like, right, you just said, 75,000. Reading that, seeing that on the notes, reading that in, online or in books, hearing it, you just kind of think, wow, that's a lot. That's it. Wow, that's a lot. Whereas you hear, one person's name died and you think, wow, that's tragic, too soon. I think it's hard for people to look back and realize how many people died in both World War II and World War I in, in short durations of time, if you think about it. I mean, really, 6 years of World War II, millions of people died. The Battle of the Somme in World War I, I think 60,000 British, there's 60,000 British casualties in like an hour, something crazy like that. In an hour, and that's casualties, not KIA. It's just casualties. But I think it is sobering to think about when you start looking at how grand in scale. Like, we mentioned Stalingrad last week. I think they estimate between 150 and 250,000 German soldiers died, and 750,000, 750,000 Russians died. Yeah. I mean, that's just unthinkable now.
Yeah.
The closest thing I can think of in our lifetime was that tsunami that hit back in 2004 in Indonesia, and there was several hundred thousand people that died.
Oh, yeah.
And they almost had like a death counter on, casualty counter on TV, and you're just watching the number tick up, and you're not really seeing people die. You're just seeing a number go up. And I think that's kind of a perspective a lot of people have about World War II, the World Wars, really, and the number of people that were killed. Looking back 80 years, 100 years.
Yeah, it's like entire towns or districts of like big cities, like everyone just disappearing. Yep. Like, that's not insignificant. Like, that would be ingrained upon our nation's history, like, in a way that nothing else has been. And yet, Americans just kind of are just like, 75,000 Jews gone in France. Like, yeah, the Nazis were bad. I think it's important for us to remember that the decisions that led to the collapse of the Third Republic were entirely preventable. This didn't have to happen. So with that, I kind of wanted to spend the rest of our time kind of thinking through, like, okay, what are the big picture lessons learned here? What are the main ideas that we can draw from the collapse of the Third Republic without reiterating the same things that we've talked about in our previous episodes, which again, I really encourage all of our listeners to go back and start from episode one in this series. But I wanted to kind of start the discussion, Colin, by asking you a question that we've kind of lightly touched on in some previous episodes, but I don't know that we've had as robust of a discussion as I think we could have on that. And that question is, what role did liberalization play in the decline of France? And are there any corollaries to today?
Oh boy, we're going to lose some listeners now. I'm going to say this tactfully, and not insignificant role in the decline of France. Liberalization, I think we kind of glorify and, to be completely honest, idolize within the United States. And that's kind of, you know, there's a lot of different definitions of people of liberalization. If we're talking classic liberalization, the modern lens that we have now. But if you just simply think of it as more of an open-mindedness and a political ideology centered around individual rights and liberty, it is a fundamentally good ideology. The problem is the moment it begins to spiral to the point, you know, I think there is a tipping point. There is a definite tipping point where once the guardrails are taken down of liberalization, it becomes this kind of cancerous movement where the individual is, there's a balance between the individual and society writ large and a nation and a state. And when the individual prompts the good of the individual and a selfish interest of an individual outweighs the good of the nation and then the good of other individuals, I think you start to have fractures in that society. Mm. And I'm thinking through this as we go, but in France, and really, if you think of that time, you're kind of post-Enlightenment, we're getting into this modern, postmodern type of philosophy, and religion is becoming less important, really specifically for France. Christianity, really among the upper echelons and the intellectual and political elite, tradition is, you know, there's, like we mentioned, there's factions that are monarchists, there are some that are just so anti-monarchy and, you know, radical communists and then radical centrists. They all have this fractured idea of what liberalization should be. And they're essentially promoting themselves and their small faction over the nation of France. And so some of the guardrails, like I mentioned, Christianity, some tradition that was really honestly destroyed during the French Revolution. A lot of those traditions, like the monarchy, kind of a rigid hierarchy that had been part of French culture since the feudal ages and the Middle Ages and really even the collapse of Rome, late stage Rome, those were all gone. So now those guardrails where you're like, okay, well, hey, we can have these individual rights, but it's all going to be bounded by something. There's going to be these societal norms. There's going to be these religious norms. There's going to be this hierarchical norm that is going to contain individual rights and liberty within this kind of this safe space, if you will, this playground, right. This pasture. And now those walls are torn down and it causes people just to run wild and political factions run wild and they go and they pull apart essentially the fabric and foundation of French society. And then you throw in something like World War I, where a incredible tragedy, a tragic loss of life besets a nation, where you no longer have really young, for World War I at this, it was really, you just lose this massive demographic of young men who are no longer able to have a family. You know, there was a generation of women who never had a husband, which whatever your thoughts on marriage are now, it's irrelevant, because back then it was a big deal and it was a foundational stone in society. There was men who had received injuries that were never seen before. You know, shell shock was there. They had, you know, limbs were blown off. The Industrial War had wreaked havoc on men's bodies, and they were destroyed and they were killed. You had civil cities leveled to nothing. So that damaged the psyche. It removed a large portion of the populace who would otherwise also guard against kind of this fracturalization that occurs when liberalization runs wild. So that is a really long way to say that there was a lot of things that happened, starting even in the French Revolution, you know, over 100 years prior, 150 years prior. But it still had something to do with this fracturalization internally, which eventually culminated in them just not wanting to fight.
Yeah. No, I actually really like how you put that, because I feel like we've said this several times in many of our episodes, but like, if you could sum up, I'll speak for myself, but Colin, you basically just said as much. Like, my political philosophy in a nutshell is maximum individual liberty checked by the common good. And it's like, I don't like libertarianism, because I think that's just maximum individual liberty checked by nothing, as long as you don't hurt anybody, which is subjective. And at the same time, it's not good for, like, definitely not an authoritarian, right? Like, it's definitely not a good thing. You know, you've got a principle of fascism was the removal of individualism and just like instituting this hyper rigid order across society, which is appealing in the same way that individual liberty is appealing, but you need both. And the overarching principle, I think, is the common good. And insofar as we can maintain individual liberty as a part of that, that's a good thing. And that's what I just heard from you, Colin. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that was a much more concise way to put it, because I was thinking through how to tie this in directly to France and kind of take some of the political philosophies and buzzwords, if you will, and sort of apply it to them. But yeah, no, you're right.
Well, so we didn't cover the French Revolution in the beginning of our episode. Like, this series started with 1870. France loses the Franco-Prussian War. There's the humiliation at Sedan. And we started there. But there's still very much the ideals of the revolution. Egalité, liberté, fraternité.
Well, it's still there. But I mean, the spirit of the revolution, the French Revolution, this is the third republic that we're talking about. I think they're up to their fifth republic now? They're on the fifth republic?
You know, that's a good question. We should look that up. What number of republic is France on?
Yeah, it's the fifth republic. So like, and you know, you had the fifth. So now we're on the fifth republic. Well, they also had, you know, Napoleon, and they got to Napoleon III. So I mean, they've had so many changes in government. This kind of spirit of just like unchecked individualism. It's kind of a bastardized form of the American Revolution. And I think that spirit has pervaded its way and kind of bastardized liberalism, or liberalization, if you will. That liberalization that occurred for them was kind of bastardized and tainted early on. And that's what happened to them. I mean, it's tragic. So with all that being said, do you think the left or the right in France is to blame for what happened?
So real quick, one last thought before we move on to that question. And that is, have you read Carl Truman's The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self? Have we talked about that before?
No, but it sounds interesting, and I'm going to put it on the list of books that
so good.
Will sit on my desk to be read later.
So this is one reason why I love The Loins of History, right? This is a podcast. This is a history podcast, but the purpose of the history is to talk about things that are relevant for today, right? And Carl Truman, who is actually a theologian, wrote a phenomenal book called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. It was like, it was huge. If you're a Ben Shapiro fanboy, like, Shapiro loved it when it first came out several years ago. And I'm not a Shapiro fanboy. I should say that. I do agree with what Shapiro says sometimes, but I'm definitely not a fanboy. Anyway, but he did like it. And basically, Truman's argument is that a lot of what can be, Colin, as you say, a lot of the social rot today is can be explained by this, by the logical consequence of individualism. This idea that the self becomes self-defining, hence the rise and triumph. It is that in today's social order, we can now define ourselves. No one else has the right to tell me who I identify as, right? And it's like once that and that floodgate has opened and caused a whole host of social problems, not even approaching this from a moral religious standpoint, right? But like the reproduction of the species doesn't happen within same-sex unions, nor, you know, when we have people who are biologically one gender claiming and identifying to be another gender. It is like, it's actually not good for society. And I admit there's some debate there in terms of, okay, it's just a handful of people, you know, blah, 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 blah. And like you said, we're probably losing listeners this episode anyway. But the point being is that like the philosophy that allows that ideology to have a foundation is this hyper-individualism. And it's like, I am who I say I am. That is peak individualism. And right, so- Go ahead.
No. Keep going.
Those roots, the roots of that ideology is in the Enlightenment, which took hold in revolutionary France. And it very much, you know, when we talk about liberalism, liberalism isn't necessarily taken to that extreme, but it is in that camp for sure.
I think it was R.C. Sproul that said people are religious by nature. So people are going to worship something. If it's either you're going to worship God, the creator, or you're going to worship God of yourself. So liberalization is really just a religion that worships, it's the self-worship, the triumph of the self. So, yeah. And that's an extreme sense, but people are religious by nature. So within Enlightenment, postmodernism, where we, as Nietzsche, I think it was Nietzsche that said, like, we've killed God. And that was one of his, correct me if I'm wrong, if it wasn't Nietzsche, I can't remember which philosopher it was, but I think it was Nietzsche. So if you've killed God, you've essentially just elevated self to, you know, a deity and an idol that you worship. So that's kind of what the end state of unchecked liberalization is. It's just people just adopt it as a religion. I can define who I am because I am the most important.
Right. Yeah.
So who's more to blame, the left or the right in France?
Oh, yeah. So I thought a lot about this as I was thinking about prep for this episode. And it's obviously kind of a trick question because both sides are to blame. But as a conservative, I feel compelled to point out the, like Vichy France, for example. One of the things that Vichy France did was they re-empowered the Catholic Church in France. Particularly Léon Blum and the Popular Front, they went after the church, right? And I'm pretty sure at that time, they probably would have said that they persecuted the church. And I'm not Catholic, but I am a Christian. And I am somewhat sympathetic to Catholicism and, you know, fellow brothers and sisters over there. But the point being is that under Pétain, the right-wing side of French politics brought back the Catholic Church, reinstated the church's role in certain positions of power and its influence. You know, press censorship was removed, that kind of thing. But at the same time, like we've already discussed, this is the same government that on the one hand empowers the Catholic Church and then deports Jews to go to Auschwitz. And it's just like, I feel compelled to talk about if people on the right, and I'm thinking pre-1940 here, if people on the right identify a problem, but their proposed solution drives them into the same camp as the Nazis, we need to take a hard look at ourselves and go, okay, you know, obviously not everyone on the right is a Nazi, but should we really ally ourselves with extremists who, you know, are also going to fundamentally bring down our society? So I guess maybe one more succinct way to answer the question is, it's not so much that the left or the right is to blame. Rather, it's the fact that the left and the right became so polarized. And that's what, in a real way, tore France apart.
I'm gonna say this question, then I'm gonna answer it, because you kind of caveated right into it. Like, was France defeated by the Germans or the French? Technically speaking, they were defeated by the Germans. Obviously, the Germans had at this point had an incredible military. They can kind of by complete surprise. However, the French, it's like they showed up to a boxing match with Mike Tyson and they just said, I'm not even gonna bother training. I'm not even gonna bother. I'll tie my hands behind my back and blindfold myself and then just walk into the ring. Yeah. 10 years prior to World War II, you know, or let's just take 1931. 1931, so 8 years before World War II, the French had a larger army. They had the Maginot Line. They had a navy. They had an air force that was superior. They had a military that was superior to the Germans.
Yeah.
In 1933, they still had a superior military. Probably up until like 1937, you could say that they were better. And they saw all this happening, but they were so busy focused inward and kind of laissez-faire about geopolitics. It's not even that you can even make the argument that, hey, maybe they didn't want to start a war. Okay. But you still need to prepare for one because it might be brought to you whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. They didn't even prepare. They were caught so completely off guard. They should have, you know, you can armchair quarterback it, Monday morning quarterback, whatever you want to call it, but they should have been prepping and having rapid response. They should have had all of the logistics set up in the event that the Germans did invade. And if something crazy happened that, you know, an instance like the Miracle of the Marne could be supported and they could do it quickly. They wouldn't have to rely on a bunch of taxis just happening, right, and, you know, being to be available in the city. You know, those things could have gone a long way. They could have done naval blockades of Germany. So to keep production of the U-boats down, there's just so many things that they could have done. It's not that they even went out to stop the Germans. It's that they didn't even prep to get attacked by the Germans.
Yeah. It's shocking. In our last episode, just for the sake of time, I didn't go into that much detail on the actual battles that occurred in Belgium. We focused really on the Battle of Sedan, in the World War II Battle of Sedan, not the 1870 battle. And German general tank Guderian.
Guderian.
And Guderian's, you know, armored divisions going through the Ardennes. Like, we focused on that. But like, when you look through the, I believe it was the French 9th Army that was on the opposite of Guderian in the Ardennes, it was the most JV army that the French had. It wasn't even at full strength. They didn't even have hardly any fortifications. They put I think it was the Second Army. That was the main effort, military speak. That's the one that went up towards Belgium and got stuck in Belgium and got obliterated in Belgium. The Ninth Army was just like this hodgepodge, ragtag force of reservists. No offense to reservists out there. But, you know, they weren't the creme de la creme. And they got obliterated. And when you look and see like some of the tactical decisions, it's to your point, Colin, it was like, were they even prepared? Like, did they have any plan or any idea what they were doing? The decisions that Gamblin made and General Georges at the beginning of that conflict, like, boggle the mind. Like, you don't even have to be a military general to think. It's like, they probably shouldn't have done that.
that's the thing. Even that's at kind of an operational level, but it's like at a tactical level, it's like, were your soldiers trained to dig fortifications? Mm. Were they trained to fight on a defensive front? Were they trained to maneuver? They weren't. That's the thing. They weren't training on how to integrate fires. They had some of these weapons like tanks and artillery and machine guns. Are you training with them? Are you integrating? The Germans, to their credit, were so sophisticated with their doctrine and how they planned. It's like, if you're going to defend yourself against that, and you know that's what they're doing for years, you know that's what they're doing. I wouldn't have a reservist army anywhere near the front. I would have absolutely battle-hardened soldiers ready to go, and they'd better be drilled pretty well. Because here's the thing, had the French not completely imploded and been able to do, like in World War I, like the Miracle on the Marne, and stopped and held a line, World War II could have unfolded very, very differently. It could have been over sooner. It would have allowed the British to regroup. The Americans could have entered the war. A lot of things could have happened if they were even able just to hold out, just to hold out a little bit longer.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's crazy is they didn't even want to hold out. I, you know, didn't go into this detail, but the time period from really like, so I believe Germany invaded France on the 10th of May. By the 14th of May, like tactically speaking, it was over. Like it was days for Guderian to cross the Meuse, to start driving towards Abbeville on the Channel, and to start cutting off the entire French Second Army. And like it was a fait accompli at that point. Like there were 40 some odd divisions north of Guderian's breakthrough in the Ardennes. And it's like you lose 40 divisions plus the entirety of the British Expeditionary Force, which we didn't even go into Dunkirk and what a debacle that was, and how the French felt very much betrayed by the British during that time.
I'm going to make one statement about that. We did kind of talk, we indirectly talked about it with General Gort, Lord Gort, withdrawing the British Expeditionary Force. Yeah. The British had to get out of there to live to fight. It's the inverse of Stalingrad, where had the Germans pulled out of Stalingrad ahead of time and said, okay, we're going to reconsolidate, we're going to fight another day, but instead Hitler was like, no, you're going to stay in the city. And then they got surrounded. The same thing would have happened to the British. And then suddenly tens of thousands of soldiers are not there to fight for the British another day. So sometimes you do, I understand the French felt betrayed, but at the same time, you're betrayed by your own government. And really you're, and this is going to kind of lead into the other question is like, how much of like, we're talking about the operational tactical lack of preparation, but like, the fact that they've abandoned foreign policy, really, where they're just kind of like, go with the flow, did that decide the direction of those, the operational tactical readiness of the military?
So, you know, I have never thought about the relationship between the withdrawal at Dunkirk and the British desire to just basically have a cop-out, diplomatically speaking, like at places like, you know, the remilitarization of the Rhineland and the Munich conference about the Czechoslovakia. And that's a really interesting thought, Colin, because while the British wanted to maintain this balance of power on the continent, at the same time, they were looking at France and going, France isn't even hardly doing anything to defend themselves. Why are we going to put our neck out on the line to defend the French? And specifically talking about Lord Gort and at Dunkirk, the French were asking the BEF at that point to attack south. So after, so there was like a 48-hour period. I'm a little rough on the exact timeline here, but I want to say there was like a 48-hour period where Guderian's tanks like made it to the channel, but they outran their infantry divisions. So like there was basically a gap. The corridor that the Germans had cut through Belgium was not reinforced. And if an enterprising commander of either the French or the British, if they just would have attacked either north or south respectively, either the forces that were trapped north, if they just would have punched south, or there were still French forces that were south of that line protecting Paris, if they just would have punched north, they could have then cut off Guderian, if that makes any sense. And there was a lot of discussion about this, and they kept asking the British But then the British were not able to tactically coordinate. And I forget the French commander that was kind of right there with Gort. And like they couldn't figure it out. And like one would attack on one day while one would be, you know, holding in place. And the Germans were able to repel them. And it was just this debacle where they couldn't get along. And the British very much, and oh, by the way, Churchill was flying to Paris like multiple times. He'd fly to Paris, he'd fly back. He'd fly back to London, fly to Paris, fly to London. It's just boom, boom, boom. Like he was seeing a lot of these French government decision makers face to face in the middle of this chaotic time. And the impression that the Brits got was basically, the French are falling apart. Like, why are we going to stick our necks out for someone or for a country that they're not even making good decisions to defend themselves? And so that was like you, to your point about Dunkirk, they were like, we got to live to fight another day because we kind of see the writing on the wall here. But, you know, in Churchill and the British did take measures elsewhere after Dunkirk to try to keep the French in the fight as long as possible. But a lot, like there's this concept that we've brought up before called defeatism, where it's just like this, there were so many French generals and politicians that were just kind of already defeated without even fighting.
And that's a good way to say like that. I think that's why they abandoned independent foreign policy. They had already accepted defeatism long before the war even began.
Yeah.
Like there was a sense of defeatism in the 30s.
Yes. Yes. And you know, this is a great segue into one of the corollaries that I see here in American culture today. I think, and there's some really interesting polling on like the economy that has come out this week. I see similarities between, it doesn't matter who's in office. Everyone in the United States thinks that our position within the world is going down, that things are getting worse for Americans, regardless of who's in office, generally speaking. And it's kind of like, but we've actually had some ups. Like the recent poll that I'm talking about is Wall Street Journal did a poll that they released this past week. This would have been 2 weeks at the time that we will post this recording, where they talked about economic, like inflation is way down right now. And yet, if you ask, you know, the average American, has inflation gotten better or worse over the last 12 months? Like the overwhelming majority say it's gotten worse, when in fact, the numbers support it's gotten way better.
Dude, so, I won't even go on a segue debunking some of those claims that are put out there, but
debunking that inflation has gotten worse or better.
No, inflation has over the past several months. However, purchasing power is still as a whole dramatically down. And most people don't, if you ask the average person, like, hey, tell me about the past 12 months of the economy, they're going to remember the past four because they're going to remember in political cycles. So they're not going to compare the past 12 months to, they're not going to look at the, they're not, what's that?
You said 4 years or 4 months?
4 years. They're thinking in political cycles. They're not thinking in the past 12 months. They just know that compared to today, between, you know, today versus how it was 4 years ago, it's worse. And it is. And there's a lot of numbers to prove that it's worse, because even though inflation's down, all of the other costs still seem to be rising and wages seem to be stagnating. So I'm not really sure. We can have a whole other economic episode about inflation and how it's calculated, how it's presented, because there are ways to lie with statistics. Mm-hmm. But to your point, and I think this is kind of how we can summarize this episode with how the French feel, what you said, that everybody, regardless, I'm even coming at it and being, I'm saying, hey, that's bunk. I feel this is, things are going poorly. I consider myself on the right wing of the political, right as in, you know, right of center of the political spectrum. And I know a lot of people on the left feel exactly the same, because I talk to them about it all the time, and they feel the exact same. They blame different things, but they feel this, the perception is still the same. And there's definitely a fragmentation occurring. The economy is a great way to, is a great, you know, barometer. So is foreign policy. Everybody's just mad about things and they can't pinpoint exactly what it is, but they're just mad as heck at each other, at the country. And it's created kind of a defeatism internally.
Right. And that's, and that really is the enemy here. The, I think, and, you know, kind of, I think this was the last episode, Colin, or in our last episode where I mentioned somebody needs to start articulating a positive vision for the country, and one that's actually believable, like
a believably positive,
not this stuff that we get today where it's like false positivity, especially, I think a lot of people just pick up on false positivity. Like when you're just being like positive for positive sake and there's no substance behind it, that's not a good sell. I'm talking about like a good positive vision for the country. It, thinking about inflation, like, yes, I'm sure if you were to compare prices today against what they were in 2019, we're still like things have doubled and tripled, right? But you know, I would remind our average Americans that like you actually don't want those prices to go back to what they were, because that's deflation and that's worse than inflation.
Like, it's a mess.
Prices go down. Guess what else is going to go down? Your wages. Because labor is something that the value of labor goes down too, if the prices and you're willing to pay less. And like economies crash because of deflation, not inflation, folks. So you actually want about 2% inflation.
You want inflation to cool. That's the term.
Which is what has happened over the last year. Inflation has cooled quite a bit. It's still inflation, but it has cooled significantly across the board. The only thing that hasn't cooled that much is the housing market, and mortgage rates are still way higher than what they were. And that can be a big problem. But anyway, I guess what I'm trying to say is like when there's this permanent malaise that it just seems like nothing that we can do, regardless of which party is in office, is right, and we're just down the slippery slope, that's actually dangerous. And I the quote that just comes to mind is FDR's, like, the only thing that we have to fear is fear itself. And the reason why he said that quote was early in his administration, and we actually did an entire episode on this. Everyone thinks the Great Depression started because of the stock market crash. It didn't. What caused the Great Depression were the runs on the banks that happened years after the stock market crash in 1929. Mm-hmm. And because of the runs on the banks that occurred over and over and over again, the small banks closed. And when the small banks closed, the small businesses closed. And when the small businesses closed, people lose their jobs. That's the Great Depression in a nutshell. And that's why FDR would get on the radio and said, folks, chill out.
Don't fear.
The fear is what is getting to y'all, not the reality, not the facts. Yeah. Honestly, I feel like that is actually a really good point to kind of close up this series. And France entered into this downward spiral due to its fracturing political system. People kind of just constantly self-sabotaging their own government. And it just created this vicious cycle that nobody seemed to get out of. And all it took was an outside actor to punch them in the face, and the entire system collapsed. Hmm. They had lost their resiliency. They lost their purpose. They lost their identity. And I think the lesson for us here in the United States is like, we need to remember what has made this republic such a great place. Like, why immigrants from all over the world come here, and they come to a country that is still free, that we have our own problems. But, you know, I don't know if too many Americans running off to Guatemala or to China or to the Ukraine or to Russia, right? Like, I know a lot of those people from those countries trying to come here. And we have to remember, like, those principles that we've been given in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, and you know, our nation's history, to kind of remember, like, no, we actually can't let defeatism take hold. We are still a great country, And it's a shame that nationalism gets this like bad rap these days, because I think it's good for Americans to be proud of their country and to like live their lives in service to the same, like whether that be in capitalistic ventures, whether that be in, you know, acts of public service, either charity or through a hospital, being a policeman, being a firefighter, being in the military, like you name it. Like those are all things that are indicative of a robust and healthy society. France lost that. I think we need to find it.
Americans should be proud to be Americans. It's a great way to close it out. Jay, this has been a fantastic mini series on our Fall of Empires, larger series. Definitely one of the most informative that I've been on. A lot of parallels to the US. I implore listeners to go do some of your own research and reading on the fall of the French Third Republic. Compare it to today. It really is great stuff. If you like what we're doing here, give us a 5-star review and a comment so we can give you a shout out on the next episode. I think we forgot to do that today, but that's okay. We'll catch up next week. Same thing on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You got to leave a comment there so we can see you, as well as if you're a new subscriber on YouTube. We're also on social media. We post from time to time. And you can also reach out to us, send us via Gmail, Twitter, Instagram, direct message. We like to interact with our fans. We've done it from time to time. Next series that we're going to do is the fall of the Catholic Church around the Reformation. So that should be an interesting one. Kind of a little outside the box because they're not a traditional empire, but I'm going to make the case that in a lot of ways they were an empire. And they had a precipitous decline around the Reformation and never really regained their status as a world power. With that being said, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this week's episode on The Loins of History.